You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 31st of January 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. On today's programme, we'll be assessing the shape of Italy's media. Now, Berlusconi is no longer at the political helm.
He's 77, so also the age will help Berlusconi to fade away and disappear from the political scene.
We'll be discussing the Chinese buyout of luxury brands with Monocle's business editor, Jonathan Openshaw. And we'll also be asking the CEO of Mövenpick why they're choosing to put their new hotels in dangerous destinations. Plus, we'll analyse why chocolate has been doing so well as a global commodity. And we'll tell you who Monocle would have in our dream EU cabinet.
Well, transport I have actually parcelled out to a country which isn't a member of the EU and indeed is not generally synonymous with good-humoured efficiency, but Russia does do trains really incredibly well.
All that plus some great songs on the Midori House playlist right here on Monocle 24. So plenty to be getting on with over the next 60 minutes or so. But first of all, here's Georgina Goodwin with the latest news from around the world.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Georgina Goodwin. Russia says it won't support an Arab League-backed plan for political change in Syria when it's debated at the United Nations today. Foreign ministers are meeting in New York to push a resolution designed to end attacks on anti-government protesters. The White House proclaims President Assad's downfall is now inevitable. But Russian political analyst Maria Lippmann says Russia is against what it sees as interfering.
The Russian leadership's not sure that measures undertaken by Western countries will stop the development that's put Syria on the path to instability. The ways they've proposed are absolutely not guaranteed to be successful.
Syrian forces killed 10 people, mainly activists and their relatives, and wounded 15 when an army bombardment brought down a building in the town of Rastan in the rebel province of Homs. Unemployment in the Eurozone has reached its highest level since the single currency was introduced in 1999. According to the latest data, it hit 10.4% in December. Britain and the Czech Republic have refused to sign a controversial European Union agreement, handing more power to Brussels. But the remaining 25 member states have approved the new pact, which is aimed at enforcing budget discipline across the EU. Iranian oil and European financial woes are expected to top the agenda during German Chancellor Angela Merkel's three-day visit to China beginning tomorrow. Merkel will meet with China's President Hu Jintao and Premier Wen Jiabao in Beijing before flying to the southern Guangdong province to talk with Chinese and German businessmen. Andrew Economus, head of sovereign and institutional strategy at JP Morgan Asset Management, commented on the visit.
Angela Merkel has to go to China to assert her leadership on a global stage. Having just taken control of the European Union, she now has to go to China to make sure that she's recognized as the stateswoman that she is.
As Florida's Republican voters go to the polls today in a high-stakes presidential primary election, Newt Gingrich vows to keep fighting for the nomination, despite lagging behind his rival, former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. A Reuters Ipsos poll earlier today showed Romney's support in Florida at 43% versus Gingrich at 28%. Tribal chiefs say around 15 people have been killed in overnight airstrikes on two Al-Qaeda strongholds in Yemen. The attacks took place in the south of the country. Local leaders say they think they were carried out by American planes. At least four of those killed were local Al-Qaeda leaders. Meanwhile, President Barack Obama has confirmed for the first time that US drones have targeted Taliban and Al-Qaeda militants on Pakistani soil. The program has escalated under his administration and caused tension with Islamabad. Mr. Obama was asked about the issue during a web chat.
I think that there's this perception somehow that we're just sending in a whole bunch of strikes willy-nilly. This is a targeted, focused effort at people who are on a list of active terrorists.
More than 60 people have died in a cold snap across Eastern Europe, forcing some countries to call in the army to help secure food and medical supplies and set up emergency shelters for the homeless. The temperature in Ukraine sank to minus 33 degrees Celsius, the coldest in 6 years, while eastern Bosnia experienced lows of minus 31 and Poland, Romania and Bulgaria minus 30. And those are the stories at the top of the hour.
Georgina, thank you very much indeed. And Georgina will be back in a little under half an hour with an update of the news headlines. Now, though, time to have a look at the global weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
And the European Big Freeze is starting to engulf more and more of the continent. It's only going to get colder. By the end of the week, in a few cities, temperatures will be nearing record lows. In Western Europe, from today, Tuesday, the frost is here to stay for days to come. And in parts of southern France, northern Italy and the Balkans, significant snowfall this week. Wednesday's city outlook in Warsaw, sunny, minus 10 by day, minus 20 at night. In Berlin, a high of minus 5. It'll be minus 20 in Berlin Thursday night. Paris, sunny, around 0 degrees, and in London, barely above freezing and partly cloudy. And from freezing Europe to mild weather in parts of North America, the eastern half of the United States is experiencing almost spring-like temperatures as far as north as New York and Maine. After a sunny Tuesday, Wednesday is bringing more cloud and a little rain to these areas. Across the heart of the US and Canada, it's staying mostly sunny. Wednesday's city forecast in New York, 15 degrees, cloudy with some rain. In Atlanta, 17, partly cloudy. Chicago, 6 Celsius and sunny. And in Toronto, 5 degrees mild here, partly cloudy. On to other world centres. Let's go somewhere hot. In Cape Town, the next couple of days will be sunny. Highs around the mid-20s. By the end of the week, highs in the mid-30s in Cape Town. Melbourne, mostly sunny. Temperatures well into the 20s for most of the week. How about Kuala Lumpur? Thunder showers and 30 degrees. That's all. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
7 minutes past the hour here on Monocle 24 and you're listening to Midori House.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 dager, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 er jo også.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
For many, the toppling of the Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi was the end of an era. But while his unmistakable presence faded from our screens, what happened about his indirect control of Italy's media? He still retains control of Mediaset, the company which owns the top three terrestrial TV channels in Italy, and which also has a big influence in the print and advertising sector. Well, to find out more, I spoke to Gian Pietro Mazzoleni. He's Professor of Sociology and Communication at the University of Milan. Professor Mazzoleni is also a speaker at London's Frontline Club on Tuesday evening. Before we talked about the future of the media in Italy, I began by asking him how tight Berlusconi's grip was before his downfall.
Watching television, a lot. Reading the newspaper, not much. Because luckily, the Italian press was not really pro-Berlusconi, except few newspapers. One of them was owned by his family, so it was taken for granted that the newspaper would have been would be in favor of him. But television, really, you could see the presence of the Berlusconian climate and the Berlusconian ideology. Even though, I must say, you know, to be frank, that even in the public radio broadcasting RAI, there was a channel, the RAI 3, which was a sort of free channel. And the talk shows, and the talk, political talk shows that were almost every night on that channel were always bombarding Berlusconi. So there was really the possibility for people to support the anti-Berlusconian forces.
So give me an example of, let's say, watching television on a Friday night in Italy. The Berlusconian climate, would it influence just the news or would it be right across the television?
right across television, I must say. Even the major television newscast, TG Uno, was completely pro-Berlusconi for one simple reason, that Berlusconi, indirectly, because he could not directly choose the general editor of the TG Uno, influenced the decision makers to choose that man who was pro-Berlusconi. Every time Berlusconi was accused by the opposition, he would come on live news and defend Berlusconi. So the news and other entertainment programs, both on Rai and on his own channels.
Now, there was a something that I saw on the internet, which was a program called L'Infedele on La Siete, yes. Which, when he called in,
yeah.
When he was accused of all the bunga bunga parties,
yeah.
And he rang in. Was that a common off? Was that, did that happen a lot?
No. It doesn't happen. It didn't happen a lot. Even though the conductors of these talk shows were always expecting and hoping that he could call in. Because, you know, the audience, of course, could increase immediately. But it happened, if I am not wrong, maybe three times in the last 10 years. So he preferred to criticize or to undermine indirectly, not directly.
Now, Berlusconi is gone from politics. Is he still in television? How strong is his grasp now?
Not at all. Before, you know, he was a public figure. He was the premier. He was the prime minister of Italy. So, the eyes were on him. Now he can, you know, go to bed with all the women that he likes. But nobody, I mean, the journalists wouldn't be outside waiting for the cars going by his private villa. But you said that Berlusconi is out of politics. That's not true. I mean, he's not out of politics. He's out of government, which is different. But he can, if he wants, undermine and stop the Monti cabinet any moment, because he still has the majority in parliament.
As an academic, do you think that there can be such a thing as impartial broadcasting when you have politicians so closely connected to the media?
Yes, public broadcasters are, by definition, in Italy. Of course, it sounds a bit funny and weird in UK, maybe. They are, by definition, connected to the political powers. And the mechanisms by which the governing board is appointed, the mechanism by which the journalists are chosen, it's what has been called in the past lottizzazione. It's a partitioning, you know. I am Christian Democrat, so I will have maybe 30% of the journalists, and I am socialist, that will be 10%. So that mechanism is still in the mindset of both public and private commercial broadcasters and journalists or the press.
And as an academic, what conclusions can you draw for the next 5-10 years of how the media landscape may change in Italy?
Yes, but not because all journalists will change, not at all. It's because technology has introduced new ways of circulating the information, the news, and people can get their voice heard with a completely different way as in the past. The mass communication, by definition, was one way. Now mass communication is in decline. And the interactive communication is coming to the fore. So look at what happened in the Arab Spring, you know, with the new media, with the social networks. All these things, all these phenomena will definitely change also the Italian journalism in the next 5 or 10 years.
And do you think this is now the end of Berlusconi?
It will be the end of Berlusconi also for... because he's 77, so also the age will help Berlusconi to fade away and disappear from the political scene.
And that was Gian Pietro Mazzoleni, who's Professor of Communication Sociology at the University of Milan, talking to me earlier on today. You're listening to Midori House. Time now for some music, and Sally Seltman with Set Me Free. And that was Sally Seltman on Monocle 24 with Set Me Free. In just a moment, we'll be picking the brains of our business editor. Stay with us.
The Urbanist is a show about the cities we live in. And it's covered everything from Moose moving into Anchorage to Jan Gehl's plans to Copenhagenize the world one bike lane at a time.
Density is something about plonking down towers, and if you have enough towers, you have a city.
Join us as we meet the people planning a better urban future and the odd lumbering shaggy beast too. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes and quips of the week, tune in to The Curator every Sunday here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programmes you might have missed and is also the perfect digest of the week in world affairs, business, culture and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
Well, every day on Midori House, we like to invite one of Monocle's editors into the studio to find out what stories are catching their eye from the week's news. Today, I'm happy to say it's the turn of our business editor, Jonathan Openshaw. A very warm welcome, Jonathan.
Hello.
I haven't seen you for ages. Every time I talk to you, you're on the phone from somewhere gorgeous.
I know, I've been gallivanting around Europe, haven't I? It's been a long time since I've been in the studio together.
You've had a proper gallivant.
Well, I was saying before, I mean, thinking we were in Europe for Men's Week, so it was Florence and then hotly followed by Milan and Paris. And yeah, thinking back to the first day in Florence, it does definitely feel like last year.
But
it was a good one.
Have we got you back for a while?
You have me back for, yeah, a good long while, actually. I don't think I'm travelling for the next few weeks. So lots more studio time.
No more gallivanting for you.
No, sadly not. I've had my wings clipped.
So that means we can talk to you about what's catching your eye this week.
Yes.
Fire away.
Okay, so first up, well, we've got a bit of an Australia theme for our next issue,
right.
Celebrations of all things Aussie. So one thing that caught my eye was the huge expansion of luxury brands into Australia, which has been an interesting one because traditionally Australia, certainly in retail, it's been a tough nut to crack, really.
Why has it been a tough nut to crack?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think there's a lot of different reasons. There's obviously the reverse season and the relatively small market population-wise meant that a lot of brands haven't really made the trip down under. You know, swapping spring summer with autumn winter is difficult for production wise. There's also, I mean, Australian independent retail is very healthy, as we know, and you know this spreads across all sectors, whether it's retail or, you know, famously Starbucks were chased from the Australian shores by the flat white, so they pulled out. So there's some of that. There's also, I think, there's a certain amount of snobbishness about how ready the Australian market was for, you know, proper luxury offers.
Was there an inverted snobbery towards it?
Well, I think in some ways, I mean, I think a lot of the big luxury houses of Europe haven't seen Australia as a ripe market yet. But I mean, what we're seeing is, I mean, that is certainly changing. And if you look all the way through, the thing that's been a constant for Australian retail is a really truly discerning consumer. I mean, with media consumption, Sydney side is, I think, the top consumers per capita of magazines. This despite the fact that they're struggling with, you know, freights and airlifted magazines, meaning they get them months late. But, you know, the consumption's still there. So, yeah, 2011 saw a big change in that.
Lots of stories that you've heard over the last few months are that Australia's broadcasting is in particular slightly behind the rest of the world. But obviously this has all changed in 2011. Everyone has just brought themselves up to speed across the board.
Yeah, hugely. I mean, we were there very early 2011. I was there doing the Monocle Guide to Sydney. And at that time, it had just been announced that brands like Zara, Topshop, H&M were all going to be arriving. I mean, the idea that these brands hadn't been there is amazing to me as well. You know, Zara, Topshop, H&M, they were not features of the Australian High Street. So that all changed in 2011. It also was very busy for luxury. So in April, Burberry opened a new flagship store in Sydney. Prada followed Miu Miu. Flagships in Sydney's Westfield, and also Gucci has opened a two-level emporium in November. So that was all huge. Louis Vuitton's there, Bottega Veneta's there, and everyone's looking to expand. Chanel and Christian Dior as well.
I mean, just wondering about it. How do you break into a market when your season is absolutely upside down?
Well, I think, I mean, it's just about planning. I mean,
right.
You know, these big fashion brands, if they want to break into, you know, they're obviously not just selling in just Northern Hemisphere markets. They can adapt. But it's just that Australia hasn't seemed to provide a juicy enough goal yet. But 2011 certainly looked like that was changing, and 2012 it looks like it will be the same.
So luxury will be quite secure in Australia then, we think?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And I mean, obviously it's bolstered by, you know, links to the booming Asian markets, China in particular. I think something like 75% of China's Australia's exports goes to Asia at the moment. And so very much the fate of Australia will be pegged to the fate of China, for better or for worse.
And you talk about China. We've been seeing for weeks and months now Chinese luxury brand shoppers everywhere on the streets of London. And also I was flicking through some magazines and there seemed to be feature after feature after feature of young, wealthy Chinese women in particular going and spending $2,000-$3,000 a day on luxury brands. Is this being continued behind the scenes as well, or is it just the Chinese are just retail, you know, they just love a bit of retail?
Well, I mean, I think there's an interesting dual story with the role of Chinese buyers in Europe, because obviously, you know, visibly on the streets, whether that's on Bond Street or on the Champs-Élysées, you've got hordes of Chinese tourists who come over. It's not enough to be able to buy Louis Vuitton. They have to buy Louis Vuitton in Paris.
In London,
They have to buy Burberry in London. So that's certainly been happening. But also, of course, what we've had more and more is behind the scenes, it's Chinese shopping on a grander scale.
Right.
It's Chinese investment capital groups snapping up European luxury houses.
Who have they been targeting?
Well, one story that caught my eye recently was the Chinese venture capital group Feng, who were notable for buying Delvo, the Belgian luxury leather brand, last year. And they have recently gone into exclusive talks with the French fashion house Sonia Riquel, looking to buy 80% stake in the company, which is really interesting because they're one of the last independently owned French companies. Obviously, there's the likes of LVMH, who've bought up huge swathes of French brands.
Huge.
Yeah. So now there's a handful of family owned French fashion labels left, and China wants their part.
Why do you think China would want someone like Sonia Riquel? Is it, you know, start small and then gradually attractive?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, Feng's a huge organisation. They've got their strategy in place. But it is an interesting one with that brand because it's not the most investment friendly, you'd imagine, for China particularly. I mean, it was founded in 1968, I think. It's this kind of very Vivienne Westwood-esque kind of enfant terrible of fashion. It was born out of a moment of kind of student riots and protest, and it was supposed to go against the whole sleek image of French fashion. So it's got that quirky edge to it. It's not a safe investment like Delvo is. So obviously they're spotting huge growth, and just having a piece of French luxury really for as a Chinese brand now seems to be a foolproof strategy.
It makes you wonder though, we've got obviously easily identifiable pieces of European luxury that everybody covets, but you don't ever really hear of many Chinese luxury brands, or maybe I am missing something out here, but you know, do the Chinese have their own brands that can be targeted by other areas of the world?
No, I mean, it's an interesting, yeah, you're really right to bring up, because it is an interesting question with Chinese luxury. Obviously, there's this huge domestic market and also huge venture capital places like Beijing, Shanghai. So it is interesting, why haven't the dots been joined? Why can't they create their own domestic luxury fashion offer? And it really hasn't happened yet. And that is going to be about the maturity of the market. It's about luxury brands or about heritage brands. It's about storytelling. It's about creating a myth. And that hasn't developed in China. But I would say it hasn't developed in China yet, because, you know, when we were in Milan and Paris in the last couple of weeks, I can't name any names yet, but there are rumblings of potentially a new and very appealing Chinese luxury offer, which would harness quality European manufacturing,
right,
but be a domestic Chinese luxury brand.
It would be would it be easily identifiable as a Chinese luxury,
yes,
brand? So you would be able to take one look at it and say, in the same way that you can basically identify something that's Italian or French or German, what have you, you could take one look at it and go, that is Chinese.
It will be a very clearly flagged Chinese luxury brand for Chinese luxury consumers, harnessing European manufacturing might.
Clever.
So yeah, it could be an interesting one to watch, and one that we'll certainly be covering when the time's right in Monocle.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. Now, before you go, I have a copy of Monocle issue number 50.
Yes, our fifth anniversary.
Congratulations.
Fifth birthday. Yeah.
There's a piece in it about Choc Tactics, it's called, about New York's chocolate.
yes.
market.
Yeah, a hard gig, but someone has to cover
it's
it.
It's really tough. You do have such a hard life going to
I know.
To your,
poor David Kaufman, our
going
correspondent.
Going to the shows and then doing Chinese lecturing well, and then having a spot chocolate.
I didn't get to go to the Chinese... I didn't get to go to the New York Chocolate Fair, unfortunately.
Oh, that's a shame.
That one went to our correspondent, David. But yeah, you know, an interesting story, definitely.
We're going to be talking about why chocolate seems to have been recession-proof. Or has it been recession-proof in many ways?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's changed. It hasn't been recession-proof. I think it's changed dramatically. But there's been parts of the market which have really, really boomed. And there's a lot of room for quality chocolate producers to do something amazing. And there's double-digit growth within that.
Because this fair seemed to be all about small... but upscale companies that were trying to carve a niche market, which is something that arguably Europe has been doing for a very, very, very long time. Do you think this is now going to spread right around the world?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly looks that way. Growth in developing markets is what's really driving the whole industry, and you know, the BRIC countries massively. So it's one to watch, and obviously the fortunes of the likes of Thorntons and the big, you know, those who are catering to the lowest end of the market, that hasn't been great and they have suffered.
Yeah.
And what you're now seeing is the people who are doing particularly well are the people who really know their product okay. and are catering to a luxury consumer.
Well, we'll find out a bit, I'll just say that again, we shall find out a little bit more about that later on in the second half of today's Midori House. Also coming up in the next half hour, we'll be building our dream EU cabinet. Stay with us.
This is Monaco 24.
Dette Monaco 24.
Esse Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
And Monaco 24, Tagatia.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
Monaco 24, Yokosa.
Tämä on Monaco 24.
The Propojala
Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
You're listening to Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
And this is Midori House, live from Studio One. The time is now 30 minutes past the top of the hour. Let's get the latest news headlines with Georgina Godwin.
Syrian government forces reasserted control of the Damascus suburbs today, beating back rebels at the capital's gates as diplomatic pressure mounted on President Bashar al-Assad at the United Nations. Florida's Republican voters go to the polls today in a high-stakes presidential primary election, with former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney holding a commanding double-digit lead in polls over rival Newt Gingrich. The chief of U.S. intelligence says Iran is keeping the option open to develop a nuclear weapon, but intelligence agencies do not know whether it will eventually decide to build one. The Eurozone creaked under the weight of record unemployment at the end of 2011, while jobless rates in Germany fell to historic lows, putting the onus firmly on Europe's top economy to take the lead in steering the struggling region back to recovery. Near-bankrupt Greece struggled on with its foreign lenders to show them it can ram through spending cuts and labour reform in exchange for a crucial debt swap deal and a €130 billion bailout package needed to avoid an unruly default. Gunmen riddled the car of Yemen's information minister with bullets as he left a cabinet meeting in the capital earlier today, but he escaped from the assassination attempt unhurt, an aide said. And more than 60 people have died in a cold snap across Eastern Europe, forcing some countries to call in the army to help secure food and medical supplies and set up emergency shelters for the homeless. And those are the news headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Georgina. Good to have you with us. Now, Mövenpick, more commonly known as an ice cream brand, is becoming one of the fastest growing hotel operators in the world. With 70 properties in business and more than 30 under construction, the Swiss company has made bold moves, especially because it's chosen to invest in volatile countries. Monocle Section E's editor, Santiago Tarditi, has spoken to the CEO of Mövenpick, that's John Gabriel Perez. He started by asking him about these ambitious expansion plans.
We are going to continue to develop Asia a lot, and we believe also in Africa. So basically what we want to do is by 2015 being able to have approximately 25 hotels per continent. We're not going to touch the US for the time being, because we think that for that continent you need to be big to be efficient. But basically having, yes, around 25 hotels per area would be wonderful.
You're a true believer in the fact that Africa has a lot to offer to travelers. What exactly does the continent have to offer, and how has it attracted the Movenpick to the area?
Well, I'll give you the example. I'm just back from Accra in Ghana. Ghana is a gorgeous destination. It has a lot to offer. The hotel opened. Lots of people would believe that a five-star hotel opening in a place like Accra could probably take 3 or 4 years to establish itself. It was basically full from day one because we are market leader there. So it's very comforting to see that you have quite a number of countries and destinations in Africa, which are yet to be discovered, where there's a great economic power and fun destinations and safe destinations too. We were among the first to be in Jordan, and now Jordan is probably one of the most prized destination in the world, and there are lots of other places and destinations. We have signed in Inner Mongolia, and I can promise you that probably Mongolia will be a very, very looked after destination in 5 years from now.
In fact, you have ventured into areas that not many hotel chains are interested in. Mongolia, as you mentioned, Palestine, soon also Bangladesh, I understand. Why invest in countries that have a bad reputation or no reputation at all?
Actually, what happens is that we are pure operators. That is, in most of the destinations, it's owners and affluent leaders in their countries who come to us, who like the brand, and we say, well, listen, you know, we've seen that you've done a great job in Egypt, in places like, as I said, Ramallah, for instance, and we would like to sign with you. So they entrust us as operators to be able to deliver quality of service for them as an owner. I think they're very much attracted by two things. The first thing is that we are the leading Swiss hospitality business in the world in the upscale segment. And the other one is that we are absolutely passionate about food and beverage. And in these destinations where the quality of the culinary experience for the guest is something that people have a high expectations about, they probably want to take a safe bet in having Mövenpick operating their property.
And talking about safe bets, what are the difficulties of starting or rather operating a hotel in unstable countries?
I think the most important, which is also a commitment that the company is making, is to educate the people, to give them this attitude. You have absolutely wonderful people. I'm going to give you an example. We have a huge pool in Accra, in Ghana. And the general manager had the idea to employ a number of youngsters from the streets and educate them to become bartenders. And these guys were addicted at rollerblading. So they're, instead of helping guests walking, they rollerblade around the guests. And it gives a fantastic appeal to this particular location. That's it. It's, you know, educating people, giving a chance for them to get a good job and helping them grow within the company.
And finally, you mentioned your cluster strategy this morning. How will you use it to cope with the European crisis? And what exactly is this strategy about?
This cluster strategy has been a winner for us over the past years because, you know, this is not the first crisis that we're facing. Over my past 13 years in the company, I've seen four already between the SARS and economic issues back 5 years ago. I think that people have to understand that we need to rely a lot on proximity business, and the domestic and regional business is very important to many of our hotels. In some instances, in Germany, for instance, we probably see 30 or 40% of the business from the rooftop of the hotel in some respect. And these people have been extremely loyal to the Mövenpick service. So that, I think, is also a lesson for lots of people. Proximity business, regional and domestic, is the one that you need to really rely on in the next years.
And that was the CEO of Mövenpick Hotels and Resorts, Jean-Gabriel Perez, talking to Monocle's Santiago Tarditi earlier on today about the challenges faced of opening hotels in dangerous countries, obviously solved in one case by placing that wonderful combination of water, guests and staff on roller skates. Stay with us. Time now for some music. This is Meng Tian and Exactly the Same. Hey, And that was exactly the same by Meng Tian, the Chinese singer more commonly to be found in Switzerland and New York, taken from her new album New Start. In a moment, we'll be asking about what the future holds for the chocolate market. That's on Midori House.
For listeners in Tokyo or visitors to Japan, you can now enjoy a coffee, a Wilkinson dry ginger ale, or our classic curry at our first ever Monocle Cafe and Shop at the new Hankyu Men's Department Store, just steps from Ginza and the lobby of the peninsula. Featuring a Monocle shop, stocked with our ever-expanding collection of special collaborations, the Monocle Cafe is the perfect place to refuel after a run round the Imperial Palace or a busy day in Marunouchi. For more details, visit monocle.com.
Every Monday, Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, casts a keen eye across the week's cultural events, taking in cinema, art, music, media, literature, and some of the world's more exclusive events. That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time and available on our Timeshift player and on iTunes.
It's an $80 billion business. Half of its consumers are in Europe, but the new growth market is in China. As we heard from our business editor, Jonathan Openshaw, a little earlier in the programme, certain sectors of the chocolate industry have proved themselves more or less recession-proof. New York's annual chocolate fair is showcased in the latest issue of Monocle, with 15,000 people attending and everything from a chocolate-based fashion show to Italian ice cream to be enjoyed. The scope of the market also now seems broader than ever. So how do you create a successful chocolate business when the market is flooded, or appears to be flooded, at every level already? And are some brands doing better than others? Well, to assess this and consider the future of chocolate, I'm joined by a global market analyst for Mittal and a chocolate expert, Marcia Mogolonski. A very warm welcome to Midori House, Marcia. Must introduce by saying, how do you actually become a chocolate expert?
Very nice to speak to you, and thank you for letting me join you today. How do you become a chocolate expert? I think you eat a lot of chocolate, and you ask a lot of hard questions about the chocolate you're eating.
So the hard questions that you're asking about chocolate that we're eating at the moment, we mentioned at the beginning of this item that certain areas have been recession-proof pretty much. How has the chocolate industry fared in general?
Well, you are right. It is, I prefer to say, recession-resistant at this point, because in this current economy, nothing is recession-proof. The market's recession-resistant in some countries. It has seen some gains. In other countries, it's been pretty flat, but in the countries in which chocolate is really loved, like the UK and the US, there is still growth to be had in the industry.
And where is this growth to be had in this industry?
Well, part of it is in the premium segment, which is something that you would allude to if you're talking about the chocolate show, which was a wonderful show. And I can tell you there were 15,000 people there probably all at once. It was really crowded. That's one area. The other area is just understanding that chocolate is an element in so many more foods than just chocolate now, and that's why it's doing so well. Chocolate is very popular in cereal, for example. More of the biggest innovation in cereal in the past year has been chocolate-flavored cereal. So chocolate is growing not only as a food on its own, but as an ingredient in other foods.
Now, I mentioned at the beginning of the interview that Europe eats half of the world's chocolate. And I can imagine that the United Kingdom is quite high up there. Where are the growth markets?
Well, the growth markets, as you said, China is a big growth market. Sales are up 19% in China. This is in value sales, in American dollar sales over the past year. China saw sales jump 19%, while the U.S. saw sales pretty flat. The U.S., however, continues to be the biggest market in the world, with $18 billion worth of chocolate sales, compared to China, which recorded only $1 billion worth of sales. So it's a growing market, but it's growing from a small base.
Are we talking the very large companies here, for example, Kraft? Because I read the other day about, is it Lacta, the brand in Brazil, which is targeted to the emerging middle classes. And what happened is when Kraft bought Cadbury, it offered Kraft an in to the South American market, which had previously been untapped.
Right. Kraft is very popular in Brazil. It's got a third of the market in Brazil. Kraft is in its Cadbury costume, the biggest chocolatier in India. It owns 70% of the Indian market with Cadbury, so now it's Kraft. Kraft owns a third or more of the UK market. Kraft, however, in the U.S. is not the biggest market. In the U.S., Hershey is the biggest market, is the biggest player in the U.S.
What strikes me when you mention those countries is that they are not necessarily places which you would associate with chocolate being actually a very useful substance to have, because India, Brazil, arguably, are quite warm places, and so you have to think about all the other possibilities connected with the melting of chocolate.
That's true. One of the reasons that the market has done so well in India is the general growth of the Indian middle class, which has led to an increase, believe it or not, in shopping malls. Now, you think about a shopping mall is air-conditioned, which means there's a lot more room for chocolate growth within the air-conditioned confines of the shopping mall. And that's one of the reasons that chocolate has grown so much in India, is that there's a place for it to live, an air-conditioned place for it to live.
So if you are a big brand, you could effectively just steamroller your way into a new market regardless of the climate or whatever goes before. When you look at the smaller brands, how are they finding their little places and growing?
Well, one of the ways, if your reporter who was at the chocolate show noticed that none of, I would say 95% of the displays at that New York chocolate show were for smaller brands, small chocolatiers, specialist chocolatiers. And it is that premium or specialty segment or specialist segment that has the most room for the innovative and bold small chocolatier to stand out.
So, I mean, we're seeing the small chocolatier emerging, especially in big department stores, which are now awash with small little niche stalls in the food areas of big department stores. How do these little companies actually find themselves a little foothold in this huge, huge market?
Yeah, that's the tough question. That's the really tough question. They have to have something that has a hook. The hook right now, there's two big hooks that I'm seeing going on right now. One of them is making your chocolate from a cocoa source outside of the norm, outside of the Côte d'Ivoire, which is the biggest biggest producer of chocolate, outside of Ghana, outside of those top countries, and going to the small and interesting niche suppliers in places like the Caribbean or in South America. I was actually in the Caribbean last month. I went to St. Lucia, and St. Lucia is a small island with a burgeoning chocolate industry. Hotel Chocolat has a hotel, a restaurant, and a chocolate plantation down there now.
So if you were, if you were not just an expert, if you were pitching an idea in this huge chocolate market, where would you say would be the way to move next?
If you were pitching an idea, you'd have to have a niche product and a niche market to buy the product. There are chocolate snobs all over the world, and it's amazing how many people become chocolate snobs after two or three tastes of a really fine chocolate. Approach the chocolate snob with a snobby chocolate. That's the way, the best way to have a hook. That's how you're going to stand out from Lindt or from Kraft, is to have a product that is different or that stands out. This whole raw food fad that's happening in chocolate now, you wouldn't see a major producer try to find a good source of raw chocolate, but you'd find a smaller manufacturer, a boutique manufacturer, who's came up with a line of raw chocolate that's going to have a market among the chocolate aficionados who are willing to try something different.
And what, on the flip side of that, would you avoid at all costs? Who have been the big losers in the past few years?
Big losers in market share? The big producers are all feeling the pinch. They've had to ratchet down their expectations. They've had to shrink their chocolate bar size while keeping the price the same as commodity prices have pushed up. They've had to basically perhaps not necessarily fool the consumer, but teach the consumer that things aren't the way they used to be, and they're going to have to pay more for the same, because the price of chocolate and or cocoa and sugar and milk and all the things that go into chocolate bars has gone up. So all the big manufacturers do feel the pinch somewhat. Then the other big losers are the smaller manufacturers who just can't get their foot in the door. And there is so much, as you said, so much competition in the marketplace that those who have a wonderful idea but can't get their foot in the door may be finding it slow going.
Finally, and I know time unfortunately is running out on us, Marcia, but what strikes me about this entire conversation is that the entire market seems totally immune to the health lobby.
Oh, don't you know that chocolate's good for you? I mean, that's what they keep telling us, and there is some proof from time to time that the antioxidants in chocolate are not a bad thing. But yes, you are right. Most people eat chocolate not because they're looking for antioxidants, but they're looking for the pleasure of the taste of a good piece of chocolate.
Marcia, thank you very much indeed. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. That was Marcia Mogolonski. Thank you very much for joining me. Chocolate expert, what a job. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. We turn now to another set of dream jobs, but possibly not quite so tasty. Over the weekend, it was revealed that the European Union was considering sending a German budget commissioner to Greece to keep an eye on their Ministry of Finance. Greece understandably saw this as interference. But it got us thinking, if there were to be an EU-wide government, who would be in charge of what? We asked Andrew Muller to come up with his dream EU cabinet, which he revealed earlier to Steve Bloomfield and Daniela Pellet.
Should we start with defence? Because any government really needs to sort of, at the very least, defend itself.
It does. And for defence, I could not go past the country in which we are now sitting, which is Britain. George Orwell did once say that just because something's in the Daily Telegraph doesn't mean it isn't true. And the fact that people, the British politicians and the British right-wing press, are always banging on about how British soldiers are the best in the world doesn't mean that isn't the case either. They are. The Royal Navy isn't what it once was, but they do still have, you know, some form in recent years.
Does it have any ships left there?
Some. Not as many as it once did, but they still have literally several seaworthy ships, which is still, frankly, more than any other European navy does. So I think defence has to be entrusted to these islands.
OK, fair enough. Let's move on to education, which I'm fair sure isn't going to be Britain.
It's not going to be Britain. No, it is going to be Finland, which is an interesting case in that they always come at or near the top of the OECD's PISA exam measurements for 15-year-olds. And this is despite or possibly because of the fact that Finnish kids also spend less time in the classroom than any other children in the developed world.
Well, is that the secret? Don't go to school.
Well, possibly, which is a lovely thought. My other pet theory is it's because Finnish children are all by definition smart enough to speak Finnish, which is, as anybody who's tried to do that will know, actually impossible because every word's got 9 Ks in it.
It has. Have you ever listened to Marcus Hippie say, "Welcome to Monocle 24 in Finnish?
I know, which is an extraordinary intellectual feat just on its own, and all he said there is good morning.
He said, I think it's 24 is Kokkinelia. I'm saying that wrong, I think.
Kokkinelia.
Yeah, it's okay. Something like that. I've heard him say it about 50 times. I still can't say it right. Okay, education's for the Finns. Good. Transport?
Well, transport I have actually parcelled out to a country which isn't a member of the EU and indeed is not generally synonymous with good-humoured efficiency, but Russia does do trains really incredibly well. It's inner city, by which it mean it's urban transport trains, it's metros are things of absolute wonder, given that albeit that they were built largely by Stalin, but the stations are like cathedrals and museums with chandeliers hanging above the tracks, and the trains are clean and quiet and they work, and their long distance railways are a marvel. I have done the Trans-Siberian, or specifically the Trans-Mongolian in my case, but this extraordinary thing which traverses 7 time zones and arrives absolutely on the minute, 8 days after you left Moscow Station. It's extraordinary.
So we've got the Russians to make the trains run on time.
Yes, the Russians will make the trains run on time.
OK, let's move on to foreign policy. Who's going to represent the European Union?
On the grounds that nobody has ever got upset with them about anything ever, Sweden.
I think some Norwegians, some Finns might disagree with that.
But even so, okay, there's regional rivalries among the Scandinavian nations, and they all tell those jokes about how the country over the border, the one thing they have that we don't is good neighbours. Yeah, everybody
nice,
in Scandinavia
nice.
Tells you that joke. The Norwegians tell it about the Swedes, the Finns tell it about the et cetera, et cetera. But if you don't count a few very small NATO deployments, the Swedes have not been in a war with anybody since 1814. Which for a country in Europe is an astonishing accomplishment.
That is quite impressive.
And that was just a minor exchange of handbags with Norway about, you know, who knows what.
who knows what?
Herring, probably.
Right, okay. I was about to say, we'll probably get an email or two telling us what the who knows what was about. Since you just said it was about herring, almost certainly we'll get emails.
A few angry emails.
I'm pretty sure it wasn't about herring.
Okay, well rescued. Banking, you've got... I'm not sure I'm with you on this one.
No, bear with me on this one. I know it sounds quite mad at this point to suggest that we entrust the entire future of European banking to Iceland, a country which in the last few years obviously stacked everything on red, saw it come up black, and therefore had to kind of hock their wooden legs to try and keep going. But the thing is, since their whole financial sector imploded in 2008 and did pretty much, you know, reduce Iceland's economy to the stage where puff and beaks became convertible currency, they have actually learnt from their errors, which the rest of Europe has not. They have actually gone around rounding up and prosecuting the bankers who made the mess. They devalued their krona because they still have their own currency, so they can do that kind of thing. Imposed capital controls, and their economy is now growing at 2.5%.
Let's move on to culture.
Again, where culture's concerned, I think we have to come back to Britain on the grounds that, you know, the language of modern popular culture is English, which was invented here, and the British, unlike other European nations, to put it tactfully, are not actually obliged to pass laws to make radio stations play their local music.
No, you're saying that, you know, Poland and it's rock and roll and...
I'm saying you can make people listen to French hip-hop, Dutch jazz and Polish rock and roll, but you can't make them like it.
Excellent, good. Keeping it British again, sport, you reckon, despite the fact we just had New Zealand and sheep shearing? No jokes.
I wasn't going to make any. But no, Britain, it did invent and codify almost all the sports that the world plays amongst itself. And I think if Britain was endowed with further power in this regard, now is at last the opportunity to teach the Europeans cricket.
I think that's a good idea.
Britain comes off quite well in this fantasy European league.
It's not going to come off well in the next one. Food?
Not Britain, no. Italy, which is the obvious choice, but it's the obvious choice.
And finally, fisheries.
This I thought of handing over to Austria or any of other of Europe's landlocked countries on the grounds that EU fisheries policy has been a shambles for so long because so many vested interests keep trying to stake a claim on it. So I think if the whole thing was handed over to somebody who doesn't care... That would actually provide you with a more equitable arrangement.
Brilliant. Sorted. Any final words?
There is one final one kind of catch-all, clean everything up possibility, which is that we just ask the Germans to run absolutely everything, but they would be within their rights to point out that they've offered to run Europe a couple of times before and everybody complained.
That was Andrew Muller talking about his EU dream cabinet. That's out all from Midori House and the team. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.